Okay, well, all I mean, the reason I put up a note about this thing about the relationship between designing, making, producing work, and the kind of the things that happen to objects, the life that they have, the meaning that they have, is that as somebody who came from a kind of making background, I find that I read a lot about the cultural life of objects, which feels like they've just arrived fully formed, as if they're just there, and then in their thereness, they can be received, interpreted, engaged with, have their life. And I don't know that it's just me that feels that, but I'm kind of slightly confused by that, because I think the things that we call objects, rather than kind of things that come from, that just exist in the world, or which of course also have intentions, all have had some sort of consciousness in the making.
Mm-hmm.
And that embedded consciousness of production kind of gets ignored. Now, maybe that it's not important, but it's... So that's really... that's what I came...
So you mean designed objects rather than organic found objects?
Yeah. I think that's why I use the word designed or made. Yeah. Things. I mean, even if it's made from something that...
Because if you make it, you're making design decisions, even if you're making it by hand, just making design decisions, which we must produce. I really agree with you, but I think it's because the discourse is written by different groups of people. I don't think it's written, because I've also been reading some of that cultural anthropology stuff, and it's as if they come immaculately conceived or something.
Writers,
because their interest comes from another direction, I think. It is a weirdness.
So do we? But do you agree with that? Do you think it's not necessarily true? I mean, especially if you've got, in terms of drawing, for example, which is what you're doing.
I suppose I need to give it a bit of thought. I suppose it makes me think about things like the how certain products come into being. Like, I learned about how the mouse comes from a roll-on deodorant, I think, doesn't it?
The roll-on washing, yes.
Yeah, and things like that really helps you to understand the final object a bit more, you know. Mm. The thought process is a sort of very lateral way in which the mind can go all over the place. And the watch that has that metal watch with the sort of interlinked drawing bits, that came about post-war because it was like the tank, I think it was modelled on not wheels, the bits that drive the tank, they come into contact with the ground when they go around.
Caterpillar
tank.
That was
modelled on that.
Yeah.
So those, for me, I suppose that's, it's interesting, isn't it? Like anything is tracing back to its origins in that path of how we got there. But because I haven't read and I don't come into contact with more the kind of design writing or makers writing so much, I don't kind of know about these assumptions.
I think the one that I've just been in is one I've asked for, which was much more about the emotional life of objects, and it's as if so much is invested in that, there's a sense that we're forgetting that they are designed.
Well, I think, I mean, one side of me can see that once an object, whether it's mass-produced or individually made, out there in the world, the whole process, the whole set of reasons why it came to be there, in a way, aren't relevant.
Mm.
You might say they're not relevant. They're not carried in the thing. You can only know about them by, like read about the caterpillar tracks, there's nothing in the thing itself that tells you. Or is that?
I think there's, you have to have two, isn't it? I mean, did you go to the, there was a show at the VNA, it was about design and sculpture, well, design, yeah, it was showing about the sculptures, how, and one of the writers said something about craft.
Oh, yes, yes.
How important craft is in terms of, as an idea itself. So I think there's, what you just said, I think it's important to have both because it just can't be one dimension, no way. Because there are some objects who have meanings, but it depends on interpretation, on language. There's also this idea of experience, you know, like the action that happens when you get in contact with the thing that you've made that's out there in the world, you know. Yeah, I don't know how to, I think it has sort of two different layers embedded within one.
Say a bit more of those different layers, so those...
I mean the layers can be, you know, there's this thing about language, this thing about perception, there's this thing about material itself and experience, you know. There's also this thing as a, the object as a tool, you know, what, if it has a, if it's made for product, for example, you know, is it going to be something in the world, or is it just going to be like a public statue that just there for decoration?
To be looked at.
Exactly. So it has, yeah, it has, yeah, I don't know, it just depends on the position you take to view that particular object. Because I'm interested in object, I'm also interested in design as an idea, objects as an idea. I'm interested in how could a sculpture or an object could have multiple meanings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how could it lie to the viewer in a way, you know? How could it tell a full story? You know,
yeah.
Because that's what it does in a way. It sort of it tries to manipulate us, the public, isn't it? The people, because you get, let's imagine you get attached to this object, well, someone else won't have the same attraction as you, you know? So why do we get so attached to this particular object? What does it have, or what do we have so dear to us that makes us closer than another person?
I mean, I like that thing about, I think that's right about those kind of multiple levels and layers. And I was just thinking as you were speaking that, I mean, there are ways in which the consciousness of the making does get embodied in things. One is, just kind of adding to some of the things you were saying, one is that thing about craftsmanship, that there is a kind of recognition of craft. It's somehow, you know, we may not be able to be very sophisticated in our understanding, we don't know about processes, but we'll recognise something as a craft object. And the other thing is, if we learn or develop a sort of taste which recognises designed, what we consider designed objects. So there's a thing about recognising craft, and there's a thing about recognising a kind of tastefulness. So talking about the moment about that side of it, not about how you interpret them, but on that side. And I was just trying to think if there was anything else that kind of...
Well, there's a functionality too, is that how does it feel to hold it or be with it or use it? Because that's more an ergonomic side of it.
Yeah.
Something
and do you think you recognise that as something that's come out of the making?
Yeah, but whether I would if I didn't know about that as a discipline, I don't know. If you might, if that doesn't sound too heady. I mean, because I know you can do that, it makes me more aware of it.
I suppose because I was just thinking the other thing I was
like
thinking,
finding a comfortable chair for God's
sake. Yeah.
You just can you ever find a comfortable chair? Is a very good example.
Yes.
It is not bad.
Yeah. Just found it. They are
better than most, yeah, but you know what I'm saying? It's, you know, that's been the goal of chair designers for many years, yeah, and yeah. We still haven't really found the comfortable chair.
And it is, I mean, it comes out certainly the discussion we had in the last group, which is the thing is, what you notice most is the uncomfortable.
It's when it doesn't work, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So what you recognise about objects is what you perceive as their dysfunctionality rather than their function.
Yeah. Well, when does that actually happen? I'm curious why do we recognise dysfunction?
Well, I have a view about that, which I use a lot with my students, which is, it's a really obvious thing, by the way, it's almost too banal to say, but it is that because when we're sitting here, we're not getting information from our behind, saying all the time, I'm sitting on a chair, it's a comfortable chair, it's an uncomfortable chair. We might get it if it's very uncomfortable. But basically, if it's working,
we don't know.
There's a huge amount of information about our direct relationship to things, which is just, you know, it's there, but it's filtered out because it's just too much, it's an overload of information.
Yeah.
And so human beings have to do that. They filter out stuff. So of course what we do is we notice when it's not working.
Yeah.
But we don't notice when something is because our bodies are programmed just to not, get on with something else. If that's working, they're going on with something else. I don't know if that's true, but I just think that is.
Doesn't that make it very difficult then to design something that you're trying to arrive at that point where it goes unnoticed or it fits so well with the human form that it's just, not something you recognise even?
Well, it is. It's as Rosie will probably know too. My background's in architecture, and it's a huge issue in architecture about it because there is, of course, a kind of general feeling that you make things that are spaces that are comfortable and enjoyable, and if you like, invisible for that reason.
Mm.
But in fact, what we find, and I understand it, is there's a huge amount of contemporary practice that is very interested in just slightly disrupting the everyday in order to make people notice it more, in order to make people have a richer sensory experience. So there's a very deliberate kind of gameplay across that line in the making, which often doesn't work because it's often quite conceptually strong, but in terms of everyday life, it may not be what people appreciate. She's to be endlessly reminded of this little step, that beautiful surface. So,
well, it depends what it's for as well. I mean, if it's somewhere that you're only going to, it's a special occasion. A museum maybe can be designed like that, but if it's somewhere you're in every day, you don't want to be able to that or aware of that rough surface. So it depends whether a building is performing or just functioning, I suppose. Because you're always talking about performative architecture, aren't you? I know very much what you mean, like, I made this.
A lot of it, you're trying to do it in a very, very subtle way.
Yes.
So it is performative architecture, but it's not of that kind of postmodernist.
Not the extreme.
Look at me, I'm big and blue.
Yeah.
It's much more.
With this board, I realised
this door handle is very subtle. That's interesting. But I think that it's something about the grip of it which makes me notice that I'm gripping the door rather than just opening the door.
Yeah.
So it's about detailed relationship to things and design. Whether they're understood in that way, whether they're reinterpreted in that way, who knows? But that's a kind of quite strong from the design and making end. And it's most successful, as you might expect, it's most successful when you want to have a spiritual
element.
And much less successful in things like offices.
Yeah.
I think there's something about something being so minimal, but at the same time very loud.
Mm.
Because you're talking about... I'm also interested in building and in architecture, but I'm interested in architecture as something that can enhance the way we behave.
Yeah.
But when I mean that, I don't mean that minimalist artist, what they're doing is they create an environment for people to experience. But that environment only becomes active when you become aware of your place and your role.
I think there's something in
but quite nice in that sort of idea of design, isn't it? And also, I think craft is very important anyways for any design, because you become, it creates some sort of...
It's a tricky one, you noticed. I mean...
Those aren't noticed, yeah.
But they're brilliant, one level. Yeah. Incredibly efficient use of material, and it's quite elegant.
Yeah.
You know, you could sit and... analyze it for some time. It's actually a very efficient design. And I like this idea of design not to be noticed, which I believe is a very good example of not to be noticed. Well, it's very efficient because of this gradation. It strengthens it. It's very, very thin material, but really is thin and very strong. But they also make it nice to grip. And of course they stack.
And they know they're stuck in each other.
And there's enough of a room. And we know that actually they're not great. We've got very hot coffee. That you need for a starring ones. But it's just this whole thing about all the pen. It was the pen I was holding that made me realise as well that actually it does matter whether it's comfortable or not.
You just said something that's quite interesting. You just said, oh, you can't pour hot coffee in it because it's... You know, it's the fact that you... that because of its condition as a material, you become aware of what it can do or what it can't do.
I'm just saying where it fails as well.
Yeah.
And that's what you've seen those, I think you've seen those in ceramic, don't they? Exactly like that. Ceramic, which are amazing. And that's when it's sort of, you've got these edgy kind of new designs, which are kind of a hybrid of the two.
Mm.
Or the solid egg box made of, again, ceramic or something. Or milk carton. They do become successful because they've just made exactly the same design, they've just made
But that's about being witty, isn't it? I suppose. That's anti-clever, I've noticed this everyday thing. I'm going to make it in another material to bring your attention to the thing you don't normally notice.
Of course, that's one of the things, that's the way design, that's one of the mechanisms through which design adds value.
Yeah.
Which is that it
tweaks.
Plays. So. Now just to go back to the thing about craft and materiality, because it's very interesting for me. I've been boring one of the other groups about this because when I started in architecture, I'm suddenly finding myself working in the fashion industry, working in fashion.
Oh, really?
Sorry, exactly. It's very weird. And what's interesting is that one of the main people that I work with, his whole background's in the luxury market, and he has a very clear understanding that one of the key things about the luxury market is that the goods, the objects, the clothes, have craftsmanship in them. They have to have quality. Part of what you buy is that recognition of something which is hand-stitched or is made with more beautiful materials or is more beautifully cut. And I just find myself thinking he's out of date. That used to be what luxury was. But luxury is now a much more amorphous thing, where the quality of a polo shirt by Ralph Lauren is not necessarily any better than Primark. The quality of the cottons and even the stitching is actually quite equivalent. And what Lauren does is just give it this aura.
Yeah.
So what you buy is the aura, not the quality. So for me, luxury has moved beyond craftsmanship to aura. Not all of it. So there are still places where people...
A handbag you probably still want in the world, so...
Well, I think, there's handbags, there are tote bags.
2,000
bags. There are recycled cotton tote bags, which are Stella McCartney, and they're 50 quid. And they're actually exactly the same as one you get cheap from Sainsbury's. So it's not everything. I mean, there are definitely, Hobbs or those people who do really good, shoe manufacturers who do those kind of English brogues and Burberry, all sorts of people, Mulberry for bags, probably do.
I imagine. Yes, so what I have a question. smuggler.
So it's, no, it's all right. Well, now it's a name, isn't it? Branding, I suppose.
Yeah. I was about to say, what happens if that's actually being termed, that you have these sets of outfits in the other shop, and you have their stuff in the other? So you transfer the outfit, but you're keeping the same name. Then what happens? You know, because if you're talking about that the craft is not so much important because it's almost identical, and then if then it comes down to names and brands.
Yeah, you should make it as an installation. You could set up a shop like that, couldn't you, and see what happens.
Well, I mean, but it's, I suppose in a way it happens anyway, doesn't it? Because you see, what they're called. When I went to India a long time ago, they said, they make a lot of counterfeit goods.
Yeah.
And basically, a lot of people manufacture stuff and you have a slightly, it's almost a logo but not quite kind of thing. Because if that's what you're selling, if it is just about brand.
No, because it's more, isn't it? It's not just having, it's also having the location. And also, you know, the architecture itself. It's like having, having Louis Vuitton, for example. And you have everything that's actually inside that store. Be something from elsewhere, you know, because it's the location and the experience you get that actually adds into that, you know. So it's that, because you can go to other countries, there's other countries who build, you know, who build false statues, like fake stuff, you know, but they look so real. But the only thing is, they don't have that experience and that location to actually to keep it.
So what's Aura now then? You're saying partly it's a shop, a place you buy it.
I believe so, you know, it's...
But then people buy it online, don't they?
I know, but people buy it... Yeah,
but it's in the imagination, and the aura must live in here.
That's why, because I think you're right about the shops. I think the shops definitely, you know, they create this feeling. Yeah. That goes back to architecture. But I think, but people are also buying these products online. So the aura must be somehow contained in the brand, which, you can experience by going to the shop. But if you just...
Yeah, but online is limited to some extent. Is that for Amazon, for example, they're planning to have a store because they came to the whole idea of having an online system was very limited to what they were trying to, in terms of progression.
So they're going to become, that's brilliant. So they're going to get, I love it. That's wild.
They're going to have it. But the only problem is they're only going to have one. Well, not really a problem because it goes back to Abercrombie, for example, they have one store. In the country, you know. So that's what
you have to get down to Savile Row to experience your Abercrombie.
Sometimes that's what you do. Is that why don't we just watch movies at home? You know, we could do that. Why do we go to the cinema?
Well, and the other thing, I mean, just to sort of slightly sideways, but it is that thing which is what those luxury brands are also doing.
Yeah,
it's obviously this visual merchandising, but there's also a much they generate events, obviously they have celebrities and sponsorship, but they generate, invite-only events, which may be completely different. They're not at the store, they don't actually sell the clothes, they might have a guest speaker, they might just have a singer. So they do, the aura becomes quite an abstract. It happens, so there's kind of all this kind of quite hybrid movement. So again, I mean, that's an interesting thing because it wasn't the original question, but it is the fact that objects pick up the context. I mean, people have talked a lot about context, but again, it just goes back to the thing that I said at the beginning, which maybe has not affected you, but for me, when I read stuff, the whole production consumption cycle and the kind of innovations in those, which in turn have an impact on how we read the object, seem to be a very underplayed, I guess. People get very focused on the object.
Yes. Yeah.
I think. I don't know if that's true. I'm
well, and the aura as well.
Yes, they get very...
I think what's interesting now is we've almost gone from the object to the aura.
Yeah.
You know, to take Benjamin around a real circle. So you really have lost the means of production.
It was partly because I read this really lovely book. I don't know if anybody else has read stuff by him. He's called James Elkin. He's an American art historian. But he's also a painter, which means that when he talks about art, there's an absolute pleasure in and absorption in the brush marks, the quality of the brush marks, the quality of the paint. So it's not saying it's better than, but it's interesting that
you know, where art criticism is involved, you know, quite often looking at the iconography and the kind of history of the artist and the kind of content of what they're trying to say, they may sometimes talk a little about materiality, about how the stuff is made, but only a little. And this guy just, somehow you just suddenly think, oh my God, he's really looking.
It's like David Hockney, isn't it? It's like, yeah. That's what's so interesting for me when I went to see David Hockney, is it's that there's very, very little to actually say about the work, because it sits so well on the surface. It's all to do with the colour, the paint, the marks, the surface, and there isn't a huge amount of symbolism or anything. There's not depth to it, and he doesn't want there to be depth.
No,
it's all about the canvas, the surface, the flatness, the modern. And I think that is so refreshing. That
It's for us to contemplate, isn't it? All right. Because it's creating a place for us to contemplate.
That's it.
So are you suggesting we might be a shift back to materiality because we've got so lost in this?
I think you can go
this kind of aura space where not even.
You can delve and search, and actually in the end it's really nice just to be entirely gratified visually and just be seduced by those colours, the play of form, the brush strokes, the mark making. It's all on the sits on the surface and that sort of aesthetic seduction is almost like what what people are craving. I don't know. That's what I get from Hockney, though. But I don't know about objects, consumer goods, whether that's the same for them.
I was wondering what you're saying about what you're saying is moving away from the craft and the well made. I guess it's just my age, and so they'll give value to that.
See, I mean, going back to the V&A show, that's what the show was about. It was about this idea of being losing craft, you know. So the show was about bringing craft into a contemporary.
No, I did see the show.
It's really nicely made, isn't it? Like all those problems.
What was the show called?
I think it was designers as craft people, or craft and craft people as designers. It brought the two words together, didn't it?
And you need to read the book as well, because the book talks of, he says something about how important craft is, and the fact that everything becomes so conceptual that we're forgetting about this thing. I would try to he just said basically what I felt that is important for art to have some level of craft. In order, you know, that it doesn't just have to be about the idea itself.
Yeah.
You know?
So when you say craft, do you equate that with skill? Is that the same thing?
Yeah, but is that but then if you're talking about skill, then there's different levels of skill, isn't there? Mm-hmm. Craft could be skills.
Well, tell me a bit, why were you thinking about that question? Is that
just
what do you think about being in relationship to skill?
I suppose in relation to drawing, we thought, you know, it's a really interesting one, is to think about how to draw well or draw badly, and what is skill, what is good drawing, what is bad drawing, and whether that's relevant anymore as a question, you know, whether...
Why should it not be?
Well, what I mean is that we come to a point where bad drawing is maybe better or more acclaimed than good drawing.
Or it's not a question that's asked somehow. The craft of the skill in the drawing is not necessarily very central.
It isn't. But what I'm getting at, I suppose, is whether the skill or the craft in design is still central.
No, that's a good point. I suppose I'd be... So you mean Shrigley gets a show at the Hayward, but everybody chooses rather not to see me Leonardo, so...
Yes.
That was quite true.
Those are kind of two good examples of somebody who can
really draw
and somebody who can draw badly and funny. But it's almost as if we like the bad funny now.
We do. And I'll tell you why. Well, to give you an example as well.
But we also like Leonardo.
Sorry?
But we also like Leonardo. You couldn't get bloody ears, could you?
Leonardo.
Yeah.
But whether we find him provocative or interesting anymore, are we really interested in Leonardo? Or are we more, I'm more interested in Shrigley.
Actually, there's two things I'm missing. It's like this week, Daniel Hurst said that he's going to make reading bad art. That's what he called
David Hurst.
Yeah. But I was thinking to myself that you're actually doing that already.
You're doing it. Yeah, for a change.
Yeah, and I was like, how can you actually say that you're going to make really bad art while you're actually, you know, you're actually becoming that?
Yes. Have you seen his paintings? They're terrible.
Yeah, but then there's another thing as well.
And they're terrible at that level of skill. Is that ironic? You know, it's all kind of thing about saying, look, you can paint badly. Yeah.
This is slightly different. Another thing is, there was in the auction, there was two paintings. There was a historical painting and there was a contemporary painting. The contemporary painting was sold more than the other painting.
Yeah.
And the question was, why? Is it because of the fact that this painting is dealing with the now? Or is it because the past has no value? What is happening?
Wow.
And
the contemporary
painting was a bad painting.
Badly made. Let's stick to this one.
We can't really be about him bad. It's very tricky.
Shucks.
Oh.
We thought we liked the power of doing that.
I don't know if it was a bad painting, but it was just that there was so much, you know, historical painting that is more craft. You know, because they began as graphic craftsmanship, you know. There were people that were paid to produce portraits.
Right.
Whereas now it's, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just kind of a really strange conversation. And I felt, you know, is it also because the artist did something? Why is it that that painting cost more than something that was really, that's academic in a way, that's recognized, but it's just in the 1700s or something. Why is it cost less?
And now, although there's extra complexities about, you know, the art market and the fact that, you know, it's like, and it can be true of, you know, furniture, which doesn't even have to be like a historical painting or contemporary painting. It can be that something that was made in the 1950s is now worth a lot, but something made in the 1980s is not yet.
Yeah.
Even though it might be exactly the same object in terms of its functionality. Oh, God, you were
Thank you.